Good morning. President Trump orders a major transformation to the country's aircraft carriers, putting faith in the power of steam. The Associated Press walks us through it.
By doing such a major redesign late in the process, you're basically introducing possibly more delays and more costs. And just from a cost perspective, we're talking about billions of dollars easily.
The Washington Post looks at whether lawmakers are resorting to AI in their work and how Americans learn to love international travel. It's Monday, August 17th. I'm Gideon Resnick in for Shamita Basu. This is Apple News Today. The U.S. Navy has faced growing scrutiny over its aircraft carriers on multiple fronts in recent days. The USS Lincoln near Iran has faced criticism over the conditions for crew members as their operation drags on and breaks records. A new aircraft carrier is heading there now to replace it, but that's raised questions about a possible vacuum in the South China Sea. Now, President Trump wants the Navy to embark on an extensive redesign of its vital aircraft carriers, despite skepticism from naval circles, at a cost of potentially billions of dollars. Late last week, he issued a memorandum to the Pentagon to come up with a plan to remove complex electromagnetic catapult systems that are used to launch fighter planes. Instead, he wants them to install older steam-powered systems. Trump first called for this back in 2017, and he's raised it frequently ever since. He criticized the current systems at a defense summit in July.
They're not nearly as good, too complex, and by the way, we had to call the ship in twice because the catapults didn't work, and I predicted that was true.
The change would apply to the Gerald R. Ford class of ships, the newest generation of U.S. nuclear-powered supercarriers.
So the process itself is actually incredibly complicated.
Constantine Turopin is a Pentagon reporter for the Associated Press. He told us the newer systems were adopted because they take up less space, and they require fewer sailors to operate, and can launch jets at faster speeds.
This isn't just a one-for-one swap, so to speak. You've got to redesign the spaces that the guts of the system sits in to accommodate the larger steam system. You have to run now steam piping to the system to drive it, whereas before it was just electrical cabling. And one of the open questions here is the nuclear reactor power plant was not designed to provide steam to run steam catapults. So how they're going to solve that engineering problem is sort of unclear.
Turopin told us that Trump's criticism doesn't square with what naval officials say. The USS Gerald R. Ford, the lead carrier and the namesake of the class, is the only vessel of its type in service, and it's supported operations in Venezuela and now Iran. It's currently using the newer catapult system.
And the Navy has come out and said, like, look, this system appears to work. It appears to enable this aircraft carrier to launch and recover planes faster than the old system. And so the early signs seem to be that these criticisms that the old system is better are not borne out.
Trump's order directs the Navy to make significant redesigns to forthcoming Ford-class ships to include the old steam system. But there's a catch. The infrastructure for steam systems don't exist in the newer designs. General Atomics, the company that makes the electromagnetic catapult system and is contracted to build them for new U.S. carriers, said that changing the plan now would introduce significant cost and scheduling and integration risks. It called for, quote, careful reconsideration. Last week's memo is Trump's latest effort to remake the Navy to fit his vision. In addition to the catapult system, Trump has also criticized the way that newer ships look.
Donald Trump very much favors, I guess, what would best be described as a World War II aesthetic. You know, he talks about battleships, and we see reporting that he's looking to redesign the Ford-class aircraft carrier physically to look more like the older carriers. So I think he's got a penchant for kind of this, for lack of a better way to put it, retro look.
The Navy is reportedly considering Trump's suggestions for redesigns, even at steep costs. And money is something that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says that he needs more of right now. He struggled to sell Congress on a multi-billion-dollar supplemental funding package he believes is urgent and necessary to support efforts in Iran.
Congress is pushing back on some of that stuff. We see in the National Defense Authorization Act, Democrats trying to introduce measures to make sure that the administration doesn't spend money on technology that isn't fully proven yet in an effort to kind of slow roll this Trump-class battleship because they feel stuff like the lasers isn't technologically ready and they don't want the military throwing money into a platform that isn't fully developed. So whether this can even come to pass is an open question at the moment.
At At a moment when lawmakers are deadlocked on how to regulate AI, its usage inside the offices of Capitol Hill is getting very little oversight. The Washington Post reports that lawmakers and their staff have quickly and broadly adopted AI to conduct research, prepare speeches, draft questions for hearings, and even write legislation.
AI is playing an increasingly active role in how our democracy actually functions.
Anna Lisroy covers Congress for The Post. She started to look into how the tech is being used on Capitol Hill after an incident in June that got a lot of attention, involving Representative Ana Paulina Luna, a Florida Republican. One of Luna's staffers used AI to summarize an amendment she was proposing to an annual defense bill making its way through Congress at the time. And they got caught because they accidentally copy-pasted part of their conversation with the AI into the amendment summary.
When I spoke to her that afternoon, she said a lot of staffers use these tools and it's not illegal. You know, she downplayed it. And when I started actually looking into what the rules were, I realized she was right.
Lawmakers can use certain versions of popular AI chatbots for official work. Writing, editing, and spell checking legislation with AI are all allowed. In the House, representatives can't use AI on final drafts of bills or things like personnel decisions. But after speaking with dozens of lawmakers and their staffers and reviewing the rules, Lisroy learned there aren't very many. They aren't well understood and they're not well enforced, which means members of Congress are largely on their own to develop AI policies for their offices.
Those can go further. For example, many of those say staffers cannot use AI to write in a lawmaker's voice.
Lisroy says the rules are decentralized by design,
so that members can kind of have reign over their own office. But what it means in reality is that rules can differ right across the hall. And we know staffers move around a lot. And so it's really incumbent on offices to make sure staffers, one, know what the rules are, and two, that they're following them.
She reports Congress has been moving quickly to adopt AI to keep pace with the Trump administration, which has spent the past year and a half urging AI use across government.
Senator Tommy Tuberville, who's an Alabama Republican, he told me that he talks out loud to ChatGPT in the car when he's driving around. He said he talks to it about healthcare, like Medicare and Medicaid. He said it's kind of like you can sit there and talk to an expert. You don't know whether or not they're 100% correct, but they put you on the right path. Some people argue that's really concerning. You know, why don't senators talk to an actual expert? Others say, look, lawmakers are generalists, and this is one more resource for them to learn more about topics they're legislating on.
But more than two-thirds of Americans don't trust Congress to effectively regulate how the general public uses AI, according to one recent Pew survey. Its future use in Congress could hinge on how people react when they discover their representative relying on AI for work.
Are voters willing to tolerate getting a constituent letter that's blatantly written by AI? Or are they comfortable knowing that their lawmakers are using AI for research? It'll be interesting to see what public opinion is on their lawmakers using these tools.
As we near the end of summer, you might be thinking that you've seen a lot of people traveling to Europe lately. Well, you're not imagining it. Some social media feeds are filled with visits spanning from Scottish farms to Santorini sunsets. And that might be because Americans took a record 24 million trips to the continent last year, and it's expected to rise this year. Rachel Ensign is an economics reporter at The Wall Street Journal who examined the trend.
The UK, Italy, those are two top destinations. But then there are these places that have just seen a massive rise in American tourists in recent years. Portugal got nearly five times the number of U.S. visitors last year as it did a decade earlier. Greece, it was four times as many. So Americans are everywhere.
In 1990, fewer than 5% of Americans had a passport. Now, more than 50% do. Ensign said there are a lot of factors behind, as the journal puts it, this unstoppable American tourist. The upper middle class has grown in the last few decades. Older generations are living longer, and it's easy to hop from country to country within the European Union. That makes for a class of American who views international travel as an essential part of life rather than a luxury.
Right now, we're in a period where these people have benefited tremendously from a lot of different kinds of assets going up, home prices rising, their stock portfolios are doing great, and those things have made it so that this group is spending a lot.
Another driver is simply FOMO, or fear of missing out.
With the rise of social media, once you see one friend posting from an amazing place in Greece or another friend posting, it's like automatically on your list of where you want to go.
While wealthy older travelers are leading the pack, Americans aged 18 to 24 are second in their jet setting, with an expert telling Axios that young people are increasingly prioritizing tourism over buying new things. But with this overall surge of travel, there are also real trade-offs for the cities hosting all these Americans. They can bring money and help local economies, but at the same time put strain on resources and infrastructure.
There definitely has been a backlash from locals who are concerned about rents rising, you know, higher costs, and then the city that they consider their city not really being theirs anymore because it's totally overrun with foreign tourists. So it's definitely a conflict that has been arising. But the thing that makes it even trickier is that in a lot of these countries, their economies are growing because of this tourism.
Spain has been a real flashpoint, with a protest that broke out on the island of Mallorca last month. And last year, Barcelona received 9 times as many tourists as it had residents. Countries have increasingly had to balance these payoffs and concerns.
There are measures that places are taking, cracking down on Airbnbs, taxing tourists more, limiting cruise ship numbers and hotel construction. But the thing is, they really have to balance this with economic growth. You know, if they limit tourism too much and it's kind of the thing that is propelling the economy forward right now, that's not so great.
Here are a few other stories we're following today. The president's son-in-law and Middle East envoy Jared Kushner held rare talks with Hamas leaders in Egypt on Sunday as he attempts to get the administration's peace plan implemented. Today, Kushner plans to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who recently rejected the proposals to run Gaza with a so-called Board of Peace in a rare public break with Trump. Several Muslim-majority countries issued a statement on Sunday condemning Israel's rejection. The Democratic National Committee has decided to revamp its 2028 primary calendar. It will now kick off with South Carolina, a state with a large Black electorate, followed by Nevada, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Michigan, and Virginia to round out the first 6. For decades, 2 states with largely white populations in Iowa and New Hampshire have started the process, but the shift is aimed at diversifying the initial set of primary voters. In 2024, the party had tried to put South Carolina first, but New Hampshire jumped the line. It's unclear when Iowa will have a primary or a caucus this time, but the state's Democratic chair criticized the new calendar of primaries in a statement over the weekend, saying it, quote, excludes huge swaths of the country. And finally, Tommy John, an Ironman MLB pitcher for nearly 30 years in the league, died over the weekend at the age of 83. John had a glittering career, but he was ultimately most known for the pioneering surgery that bears his name and revolutionized the sport. In 1974, John tore a ligament in his elbow, an injury that typically ended careers back then. But as he told reporters that year, he felt he had no other choice but to take a gamble in the operating room.
It just got to the point to where, oh, I could throw maybe 3/4 speed. But whenever I tried to get the little extra pop on the ball that you need to get guys out, I just couldn't do it. And it just came down to the point that the season was growing short and I had to make a decision.
The doctor who performed it gave it 100-to-1 odds of success, and it was thought to be a very risky procedure, essentially taking healthy tendon from another part of the body and fixing the torn band inside the damaged elbow. But the experiment worked, and John pitched for 14 more seasons. Since then, the surgery has become more common as pitchers look to throw harder and harder. It's extended countless careers, including star pitchers Justin Verlander, Tarek Skubal, and Shohei Ohtani. On Sunday, the Dodgers held a moment of silence before the game in John's honor. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the News app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. Bloomberg Businessweek reports on how the use of concrete, one of the world's most ubiquitous building materials, is both harming and helping the planet. If you're listening in the podcast app, you can follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story. And I'll be back with the news tomorrow.